for the Commonwealth, Charles R. Samuel, and Helen Council, Rachel L. Yates, Assistant Attorney General, Appalachia Council.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Charles Samuels. I represent Rorica Custis on his appeal requesting a new sentencing hearing on all three charges he was convicted of back in 2008. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The issue today is whether or not it's appropriate when the trial court arbitrarily and capriciously sentences someone outside of the allowed sentencing to order a new sentencing hearing on all three charges. About a year and a half ago, the Graves case came out, and I acknowledge that's going to be a hurdle for me. What the Graves case, of course, said was on the 18.2-53.1 charge, there's only one sentence, 3 minimum mandatory years. In this case, the judge sentenced my client to 5 years. So there needs to be a new sentencing on that one. Now, that only shaves 2 years off a 40-year sentence. He was originally sentenced 5 years on
the... It shaves 2 years off of the void sentence. Why would we shave anything off of the not void sentences?
And, Judge, I would argue that although that sentence is void, it informs the arbitrary and capricious nature under which the trial court sentenced Mr. Custis on the other two charges because... You see this time and time again on page 168 and 170, 3 times over. He was listed as a violent felon. Mr. Custis' criminal history at this point in his career of an extremely dangerous career criminal is how the trial court put it in its explanation of why they went above the sentencing guidelines.
Yeah, but you
five
have,
times over. Was
you
that
have to cross a hurdle that I don't know how you can do it. If the other sentences are not void, then this is not a direct attack. This is not a direct appeal. This is not direct review. It's a collateral attack.
Well, I can appreciate that point, Judge. However, when Mr. Custis was sentenced and raised this issue, the trial court again said he's an extremely dangerous career criminal. His criminal convictions at that point were as a 15-year-old.
Can make all sorts of mistakes. And if the mistakes don't render the sentence void ab initio and it's not reviewed on direct appeal, it's done. Unless there's a habeas.
And that's why we're arguing the end of justice exception to this case, Judge. Because his career as a criminal at this point was joyriding as a 15-year-old, unauthorized use, not even with the intent to permanently deprive the car owner of his property, and then a misdemeanor assault out of Maryland. Those are not career criminals. He had some status offenses, probation violations, parole violations, and the like, as a juvenile as well. But that is the situation that he landed himself in front of this judge. And the question for this court is, when there is a problem with a sentence, when the trial court thinks they're sentencing Charles Manson, but it's really Shirley Temple in front of them, should this court be able to ask the trial court why they came up with such a harsh sentence? Now,
counsel,
obviously,
is there a possibility that you are reading too much into 168 when you conclude that the court thought he had a prior felony? 174, number of prior felony sentencing events, 0. And when we look at the criminal history, it clearly shows that the Maryland charge was not a conviction. And
yes, ma'am.
So it's inconsistent, but there is evidence in the pre-sentence report from which the court could have concluded there was no Maryland felony conviction, and for whatever reason decided that all of these status violations, probation violations, rendered this guy a dangerous person, or whatever the language was.
I understand that, Judge, but when the trial court has to resolve the issue with career criminal, extremely dangerous, with insubordination at school, I think it informs the judge's decision-making in this situation. Additionally, on page 181 and 182 of the...
But that doesn't make it void ab initio. I'm not sure I'm following.
Judge, what we're asking for is for this court to carve out a very small, unique niche in reviewing sentences that may technically fall within the term prescribed by the General Assembly, but are so wildly off from what a recommendation from the suggested guidelines are so wildly extreme compared to what is normally done that it merits attention and review. Justice Powell, to your point, if you look at 181 and 182 of the sealed appendix, you'll see the judge put check marks by every commitment, every guilty finding, including the robbery.
But it's
from Maryland that was actually null pros.
Which shows that it was null pros.
And yet
so
the
check mark would indicate the judge read across the line, Worcester, Maryland robbery, March 2007, null pros, and so he knew that it was not a felony conviction.
And that could be, Judge, and yet three times over he notices in this file that he has, in fact, in front of him, a violent felon. And that lays out in his conviction, or his sentencing, rather, under the 308.2 charge. Because in that one, now, even though it was just joint or unauthorized use back when he was 14 or 15, the judge didn't give him the minimum mandatory 2 years
but you see
for
where,
the first
you
offense.
See where you are, though, conceptually. We don't do what you're saying even on direct appeal. Even when it's a direct appeal from a criminal conviction, there's no 21-day problem, it's been a notice of appeal, properly filed, timely filed, comes up, we don't do at all what you're saying, which is, well, we think this is just a little too harsh. It's within the statutory norm, but we can second-guess that on Mount Olympus. We don't do it on direct appeal. You're on collateral view, which means if you were right in your theory, a defendant could bring this argument 50 years after the conviction and have a set of judges on appeal say, well, in hindsight, I just don't think that was a good sentence.
And Judge, that's why I believe there needs to be a test to determine when it is appropriate to do that. And it would have to start with the same questions of the ends of justice. And I want to answer your question. I do want to try to get back to yours as well.
No.
Okay. The first question obviously ought to be, was there a mistake or seemingly a mistake? And then the second question is, why was there the mistake? Third question is, did the mistake bleed over to the other charges? And then lastly, was it a harmless mistake? In this case, the mistake is clear. The judge saw this mistake. He had 4 lines in the sentencing guidelines to write down exactly why he was going 5 times over the limit, or the recommended limit, on sentencing guidelines. He only needed 4 words, extremely dangerous career criminal. He could have sentenced him to the minimum mandatory 2 years on Section 308.2, but instead, he gave him 5 years without any suspended. That's the minimum mandatory on a violent felon possession of a firearm. And then lastly, the robbery. I admit 30 years is less than life, but at that same time, that is wildly ahead, 3 times, 4 times over, what is actually recommended for all 3 charges. I know this is a big ask. I know what I'm saying is for you as a Supreme Court to decide that as long as it's within the boundaries of what the General Assembly allows is no longer sufficient for us to kick it out. I'm asking this court to carve out a small niche for these cases where there's an obvious mistake as to who the trial court thinks they're sentencing. We need a test for this because without it, we get into a situation just like the one we're in. We're asking for something like the Michigan test for proportionality, the seriousness of the current offense, the seriousness of the offender's past. And what you have here is an offender who has been nothing but a model prisoner. I know he's at Red Onion, but that's only because of the length of
and
sentence.
What is our authority to do that? It's not statutory. So is it a constitutional provision that would give us the... I mean, we have to follow the law, and so absent an express legislative authorization, on what grounds would we do what you ask us to do?
Judge, I believe you have the opportunity to do these grounds in a number of ways. What I would first suggest is that we look at the Booker case from the federal courts about how appellate courts review guidelines. We have the option of
right, but that's
that.
The federal model is very different, as you know.
I mean,
we have advisory guidelines. Our system is entirely different.
I don't disagree with that, Judge. I'm just suggesting a way that we can get to a place where folks, and it's very rare that this situation comes up. I mean, nobody who gets convicted wants to spend their time in prison, I'm sure. But there comes a point where the trial court sentences somebody under mistaken facts. And that's the problem here, is the underlying facts at sentencing did not line up with the person being sentenced.
Counsel, did anyone at the sentencing say, hold up, wait a minute, Judge, are you confused?
No, ma'am. In fact, it took 10 years for this court to be willing to hear this case. My client in 2008 made two attempts to draw attention to this matter, and both were denied. He appealed to the Court of Appeals. They said everything was within the range, even though it wasn't. We're not doing it. He persevered. He asked again in 2016.
No, my question is at the actual sentencing where you're saying it is obvious that the trial court made a mistake, did anyone at the actual sentencing say, excuse me, Judge, apparently you're confused. Do you think he was convicted of a felony in Pennsylvania?
No, ma'am. At the end of the trial court got the very last word in, as I recall, and said, I'm going to sentence this, and then that was it. And that was the end of the trial. There was no other action taken by either side.
So your legal principle is, on collateral review, a defendant can say that the court made a mistake of fact that I can demonstrate from the record, and that makes the sentence void ab initio. It can be vacated at any time. Is that the legal principle you're advocating?
The legal principle I'm advocating is when there is a mistake of fact, when that is discovered or when the court is willing to hear it, because my client discovered this and has been asking for it for quite some time, of course, when the court is willing to hear it, the court then has the ability to decide whether or not this mistake of fact
is appropriate
for resentencing. So what if
Mr. Custis shows up and files a motion to vacate 20 years later and says, you know, there's been a mistake of fact. I didn't do it. I'm innocent. Huge mistake of fact. I got sentenced based upon that. Why wouldn't your logic say, well, that's a great argument. Let's set up an evidentiary hearing and retry the case again.
I believe that would be more in terms of a writ of actual innocence. And I know Mr. Custis has been through that. Both of his co-defendants have sworn under oath he was actually passed out in the backseat of the car, didn't take part of this robbery, but that ship sailed. But that is exactly, Your Honor, what has occurred, and that would be the appropriate venue for that situation.
So the mistake of fact he can get collateral review on is a trifling mistake of fact involving reading the PSR, but he can't get a collateral review under your theory for something like, I didn't do it, it was a huge mistake of me even being here.
Well, again, Judge, I didn't do it, it's a mistake for me to being here with sufficient evidence would be the writ of actual innocence. If the judge, through evidence presented, shows that the judge mistook this person's criminal record for something worse than it was, and sentenced him outside the guidelines because he thought the guidelines were wrong due to the violent history this person didn't actually have.
As opposed to mistaking him for being a criminal when he's not a criminal. That would not be enough.
Judge, I think first the person would have to go through the writ of actual innocence.
Okay, he goes through and loses. And we still have the power under your theory. The judiciary can always, after the fact, basically do perpetual review forever of everything.
I know the court loves finality. I don't disagree with that. There does need to be a time for finality in each case. However, in this case, in these very small number of cases where there is a clear and obvious mistake of fact laid out in black and white letters, I think it would be appropriate to have an opportunity for the court to send it back for rehearing.
Would you like to save the remainder of your time?
I would very much, Judge. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Rachel Yates on behalf of the Commonwealth. Ryrica Custis was sentenced to 5 years for a first offense use of a firearm conviction. And he is correct that that is 2 years in excess of the statutory maximum. As such, this court has made clear that the appropriate remedy is to vacate the excess portion of that sentence, in this case 2 years, and remand the trial court to issue a corrected sentencing order. He is not entitled to a new sentencing hearing on the use charge, and especially not a new sentencing hearing on the remainder of his charges.
Well, I look at the pro se petition. That's what we're operating on, right?
I believe there was an amended petition as well.
Can you tell me what page I'll find that?
Thank you.
you can help if you know the page. What is it?
I'm looking at a petition that's dated August 29th, and I'm sorry, I don't have it in my my notes for where in the appendix that might be.
Yes, sir, do you know the page?
Your Honor, the amended petition was filed on August 29th, 2017. The reason was...
I want to know what page it's on in the appendix.
No, it looks like we neglected to designate...
Where?
It looks like we neglected to designate that in the appendix.
Well, Counselor, why I couldn't find it. The actual pro se motion, it doesn't request the relief that is being requested here. And that's why I wanted to know if there was something that supplemented it. The pro se motion focuses on the entire sentencing order, which had three offenses, and says that the entire sentencing order is void ab initio. Of course, we have decided that question quite some time ago. The entire order is not void ab initio. It's only the sentence that is in excess of the statutorily permitted time that could be void ab initio. But the actual request in the petition is to set aside the entire sentencing order, altogether, everything. Well, we know that's not the case. We've already decided that question. But the argument that's being made here today is that that you went beyond the statutory maximum in one, and that that is somehow evidence that the permitted sentence under statutes was arbitrarily and capriciously rendered, and I don't see anything in what I see as the pro se motion that even addresses that question as being an issue before this court today, and it's really the only argument that's being made that hasn't already been decided.
Yes, Your Honor, you're correct. I don't believe that was made previously. I do know that the assignment of error was amended in this case, but otherwise the court is absolutely correct that the relief requested now today, the relief requested on brief, is different than that what was made in the pro se petition. That's correct.
All right.
Perhaps that's a more straightforward way to dispose of this case. Otherwise, in terms of the remaining issues, the other sentences are not void ab initio. They are not otherwise properly before this court. I would rest on my brief unless the court has specific questions as to those remaining issues otherwise.
All right, rebuttal.
Your Honor, see the wonderful joy of taking on a case after all the petitions have been filed, the rehearing has been granted, and then it's just time for the briefing. I will tell Your Honor that the reason the assignment of error was changed is after lengthy and multiple conversations with my client. I understood what he was trying to say as far back as 2008, but as a gentleman, frankly, who was using cocaine, alcohol, and marijuana from age 12 forward, who did not have a GED when he wrote these things. I am in a position where I do have to deal with what my client is trying to say, although inarticulately, through my brief on this appeal. And I would point out that although it is one piece of evidence that, that there are multiple pieces of evidence as to why the other charges, sentences, are inappropriate in this case. It's not just that he had the void ab initio result in one charge. It's not just the judge saw time and time again in the pre-sentence report that he was a violent felon. It's not just that he got the 5 years, the full amount of time with none suspended,
on charge 308. It's not just that the judge, after looking at the criminal record, decided he was an extremely dangerous career criminal with one misdemeanor and one unauthorized use felony as a 15-year-old. It's all of those things combined. And again, what I'm asking for today, what Mr. Custis has asked me to do today, is convey to you the belief there needs to be a niche carved out when the person is sentenced within what's allowable under the General Assembly's plan, but is still extremely varied from what the guidelines recommend. And we're asking for an opportunity to have that niche carved out so that he can have a resentencing hearing on all three charges.
Well, Mr. Samuels, you need to know that we appreciate your dilemma. It happens here a lot. And you soldiered on nonetheless, and we appreciate the fact that you did so.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right, the court is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.